Blog Talk Radio.
Eastern family, thanks for listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Thank you for joining us for episode 16 of the Eastern Files. The program is dedicated to memories and stories of former Eastern people and news from the new Eastern as it comes to us. These broadcasts will usually are about 1/2 hour in duration. However, today's show is a little bit longer because I think you'll really enjoy listening to a great story by a great man. We always broadcast our From the Eastern Files at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And sometimes we even throw in a music selection. The program is not a talk radio format, and we don't take calls during this time. It's reserved only for Eastern stories, history, and news. We continue to broadcast our normal talk radio call-in live show on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. We hope you like this new addition to the EAL radio show.
Yep, scramble. Let's not keep them waiting.
At the Eastern Air Shuttle, we have a crew on standby whose sole mission is to fly you to Boston or Washington whenever one of our regular shuttle planes is full. And for that reason, we at the Eastern Air Shuttle Service can guarantee you something no other airline can. A seat. The Eastern Air Shuttle, a guaranteed seat without a reservation.
This past October 25th, last Tuesday, just 2 days ago, we lost a great individual in aviation, an individual that was loved by so many people. He entertained so many people during his lifetime, and he worked to protect the freedom of America, World War II. And I believe you'll appreciate what we will put on the radio show is a recording that was done at one of his last talks that he had. With his gravelly Tennessee drawl and his trademark straw Panama hat, R.A. Bob Hoover was an icon of American aviation prowess and heroism. One of the most flamboyant escapees was escaping the Nazis. Escapes was escaping the Nazis in World War II by stealing one of their planes. The legendary aviator died at his home near Los Angeles on Tuesday at age 94, according to the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Hoover was born January 24, 1922, in Nashville, Tennessee, and he began flying at the age of 15. In his early years, Hoover taught himself aerobatic flying and vanquished recurring air sickness through the force of repetition, according to a 2010 Smithsonian interview. His precise flying and technical skills as a test pilot earned Hoover the title of the greatest stick and rudder man who ever lived. That superlative was given by none other than General James Jimmy Doolittle, his close friend and leader of the April 1942 Doolittle raid on Tokyo. An Army Air Corps and later Air Force veteran of both World War II and the Korean War, Hoover was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for rescuing a damaged B-26 from a beach in Sicily. After being shot down in 1944, Hoover spent 16 months in a Stalag Luft I, a German prisoner of war camp on the northeastern coast of Germany, according to the National Aviation Hall of Fame. Hoover jumped a barbed wire fence while the guards were distracted by a stage fight. He stole a lightly damaged Focke-Wulf FW-190, flying it to freedom before ditching the plane in a field in the Netherlands. After the war, Hoover became a test pilot and flew through a time when flying records would fall one by one and new aircraft were being developed to go higher, faster, and farther. October 1947, he flew the chase plane alongside General Chuck Yeager as he broke the sound barrier, traveling past Mach 1 for the first time in the skies over Southern California. As Yeager's backup, Hoover always expressed regret that he wasn't the first. He spent the most tense days of the Cold War testing fighters at North American Aviation. Hoover served as captain of the 1966 U.S. acrobatic team in Moscow. After leaving the aerospace business, Hoover became a hallmark of the air show and race circuit. He flew in more than 2,500 civilian and military air shows in the U.S. and around the world, according to the Smithsonian, thrilling those on the ground with his trademark routine, that is, shutting off one or both of the engines on his North American Rockwell Shrike Commander 500S while performing loops and dives. A precise aviator, Hoover famously was able to pour a glass of iced tea in the middle of a barrel roll. Hoover's famous green and white stunt plane sits prominently under the wing of the Concorde supersonic airliner at the National Air and Space Museum Annex in Chantilly, Virginia. Now, we want to play a speech that Mr. Hoover made. I was fortunate enough to meet Bob Hoover about 4 years ago at the air show at Lakeland, Florida, known as the Sun and Fun. And it was just an honor to meet the man. Listen to some of his stories, which we have today on the show. And we'll start off by his introduction.
In the words of Jimmy Doolittle, Bob Hoover is the greatest stick and rudder man who ever lived. That's a pretty good authority, so without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. R.A. Bob Hoover.
Certainly, thank you, and I feel so privileged to be here to visit with you this evening. First of all, I want to explain, I've had bailout one too many times, and I hit the tail on one of them and broke both legs when I hit it, and I was going 500 miles an hour, I had both fire warning lights on and burned my controls away, and I planned to eject, but it was the first ejection seat that we ever had, and we copied it from one of those German airplanes that you saw flying there, which I evaluated. Had the engine mounted above the cockpit, back and aft of it, but up above the fuselage. And the idea of designing that seat was to keep the pilot from getting sucked into the engine inlet. And we didn't copy quite well enough, and the seat didn't work. So I went out at 500, and I was scared to move because the charges were so enormous. If you weren't in position, it'd surely break your back. This one accident where I broke my legs is, with time has given me a problem. I would like to recognize my co-pilot, Bob Morgenthaler, that you saw him in this film, Into the Sable Line. I fought as hard as I could to get a single pilot operation for that airplane. When we tested it, we built it, designed it and built it as a one-person airplane, pilot, one pilot only. But then when it went commercial, we were required to have two pilots, and I tried to get a waiver, but I wasn't successful. So Bob, bless his heart, he said, I'll go with you. And so that for the next 5 years, I had a lot of fun. I thought I would talk to you a little bit about the pleasure it is of having met so many wonderful people. My flying career has been absolutely delightful, but I've had the privilege of meeting more nice, wonderful people, people with great experience that I admire and respect, men of accomplishment. And I think I'm more lucky than most people because there are a few people that have met so many of the people that I have become friends with. And I'll start off, since this is Lindbergh night, I got to know him very well. I was demonstrating an airplane over in Germany, one of our jet fighters, and a lot of people crowded around when I came back to my parking spot, and this old gentleman came up to me and had on a belt hat and about a 1930s suit with a belt across the back, a cloth belt, and he said, I'd like to talk with you privately. And I said, well, sir, I can't be impolite to these people. If you could just wait a few minutes until, like, I just don't want to not sign autographs for them. I'll let them get their pictures taken. And so he politely backed up to the edge of the group of people that were there. And when I got the thin rail and felt I could excuse myself, I went over and I said, I'm very sorry, sir, that they had you wait on me. And he said, I want you to know how much I appreciate watching you fly. And he said, the announcer was saying how you're into research and development. And he said, I'm Charles Lindbergh. And I couldn't believe it, you know, this is Charles Lindbergh. And so he said, I go by the name of Swartz. And he said, as you probably know, I've been in obscurity for almost 30 years. And he said, the one thing I have missed is not being able to keep up with what's going on in the latest designs. And North American was on the present edge of more accomplishments than any other company in the industry at that time. We got into space. We built rocket motors. And one of my former bosses is here, and that's Buzz Hallo. And he was one of the greatest people you could ever work for. But he was at North American, and Lindbergh came to me. He said, when are you going back to the States? And I told him, and he said, I'm going to go on that flight with you. He said, I'll make the reservations. And I looked at him, and he said, I'm a member of the board of directors of Pan American Airlines. And he said, I'll take care of your reservation. He said, I want to visit with you and learn as much as I can. And so he told me he had a top secret clearance. And we had a great visit. 9-hour flight, and those were in the prop days of the Stratocruisers. By the time we got to New York, we were pretty well acquainted. And I assured him that I would get with our security people and see if I could work out the arrangements for him to come out. And I could give him private sessions with some of our top scientific people. And oh, he was just as happy as he could be. And sure enough, I went in to see the co-founders of the company, Dutch Kennenberg and Lee Atwood, and I told them of the experience. And they said, Bob, you just do anything you can for him, but you got to be sure that security clearance, that you see a copy and that our security people see a copy. Because he was really interested in the stuff that was far out. And so I took care of all of that. And he called me up and he said, I'm going to be arriving at such and such a time. And can you pick me up? And I said, yes, sir. And I did. And we put his luggage in the back of my car and I brought him over. And the tragedy of this whole thing is that all of those outstanding scientific people that I would call up and say, I've got a gentleman that needs to be briefed on whatever expertise they had, they never knew that they were briefing Charles Lindbergh. And I often thought, wouldn't it have been wonderful if they had known that? Because I tell you, I was just so honored to get to know him. Well, this went on for years. And I got to know him real well. He'd been in my home. And I told him one day, he talked to me about the Society of Experimental Test Pilots. And he said, what is that organization? So I explained it to him. He said, boy, he said, that sounds like a fine organization. And I said, yes, the chief engineer that I was working for, when it first started, they wanted me to run for president. And I asked the vice president, also he was a member of the board of directors, and the chief engineer, and I said, Ray, I've been invited to run for president. This is a great organization. He said, another blooming union. And I said, no, sir. I said, we want to open up the windows of aviation, because if we share what we're learning with each other without giving away company secrets, we'll all live longer and we'll have better aircraft. And he said, well, you won't ever join that organization as long as you're working for me. And if you do, you can find another job. And I said, well, Ray, I'll skip it. And so I kept in touch with him. And finally, he left the company. He retired. And they called me up and when they heard that he was leaving. And they said, will you run for president now? And this was in 1969. And I said, you bet I will. And so I was elected president, and we have a symposium yearly. And I called up Deke Slayton, who was head of the astronaut group in Houston, and I said, Deke, my friend Neil Armstrong and the Apollo 11 crew are back from the moon. And I said, I've got a coup that would be the greatest thing in the world. I would like to have Lindbergh or the Apollo 11 crew on stage at the symposium. And nobody had seen Lindbergh, even knew what he looked like for all these many years. Well, Deke said, boy, who? He said, you know how to call on your friendships. He said, do you realize they're in quarantine until the day before the meeting you're talking about? And I said, yes, I'm aware of that. He said, well, they haven't even seen their families. And I said, I'm aware of that. And he said, well, he said, I'll think about it. And I said, Deke, just think now. These two icons in aviation, this has happened within our lifetime. And I said, I think everybody would really like to hear of this and see what's happening. And so we had a lot of coverage there. And I called Lindbergh, and I'd been talking to him for quite a while about trying to get him to join, become an honorary member of the organization. He said, I really want to do it, but I don't want to come out of obscurity. I don't want to be recognized and bugged with cameras and autographs. And I said, well, I can't promise you anything in that regard. He said, well, can you bring me in the back door and scoot me back out and have some security people with me? And I said, I'll do it, but I think you could walk through the front door. It's a black tie event. And I said, everybody wants to see those about 11 crew members, and I said, they won't even know who you are. Well, he finally said, okay. And when he showed up, I had the presidential suite, and I was having a private cocktail party with my friend Baron Hilton and his father Conrad when he was alive, and Bob Hope was a close personal friend of mine, and I had Bob Hope there. Had a lot of very interesting people, and they had the Apollo 11 crew in there. And when he arrived, nobody recognized me. He said, where are you taking me? And I said, I'm taking you up to introduce you to some friends of mine in my private suite. And I said, that's all I want you to do. And I said, they're friends of mine, and if you're going to do this, I'd just like to have them meet you. And so he said, I don't want to do that. And I said, okay, what do you want to do? He said, I want to go to your room, and I want to read you my speech. And I said, oh, well, I got a bedroom right off of the suite. I will go up there. Well, he got out his speech, and he read it to me. And all the time, I wasn't even hardly listening to him because I'm worried about the whole program. He looked up afterwards. I finished. He said, well, what do you think? I said, oh, boy, that's just great. It was about conservation and the dullest thing I've ever heard in my life. But his personal appearance was such that nobody cared what he said. It was Charles Lindbergh. Well, I opened the door after I told him that, and we went into the suite where everybody was having a drink. And Bob Hope always had a cameraman with him. And that was one of his big bugs about coming out of obscurity. And boy, his cameraman was right there ready to take the picture when we walked through the door. And I just put my back right up against his camera. And I asked Bob, I said, let's get your photographer out of the room because I'll tell you about it later. But I said, he's pretty shy. And then he mellowed a little bit, and I shook hands with the astronauts and all of my friends. And it was one great night when we went into the table for the beginning of the evening. And so he was walking along. Nobody knew who he was. Just another person. And they were all looking at Neil. And he was, I had him seated in one seat. I had my wife in the next seat, and then Charles Lindbergh in the next one. And the press took a picture of the four of them, and I was sitting on the other side of Neil. And that picture was on the front page of every paper across the world. It went out on the Associated Press. Well, he wasn't obscure anymore. Well, that's just one of the many fortunate experiences I've had with my great friend Jimmy Doolittle. He was a hero of mine, as Lindbergh had been, and Roscoe Turner, and all the famous aviators of that time. And Jimmy saw me fly away, put on a demonstration with one of the fighters. And he came over, and he was a three-star general, and I was a lieutenant. And he said, I've never seen any flying like that. And I looked at him, and I said, sir, you're the greatest aviator that ever lived. And he said, I've never seen anything like what you've just seen. And he said, I want you, I know protocol will let you call me Jimmy, with other military people around, but from now on, I want you to think that I am Jimmy Doolittle, and we're going to be friends forever. And we did become very close friends. And I was with North American Aviation, and of course, they built the B-25 that he made the 16-plane raid on to Tokyo, and that was the first raid after Pearl Harbor. It was April of 42, and he got the Congressional Medal for that. And after the war, Dutch Kennenberger and Lee Edwards said, let's have a reunion for the Tokyo Raiders. each year on the date of their flight, and we'll pay for it. And so I went to call up Jimmy, and I said, North America wants to do this. And he said, oh, boy, that is absolutely great. And so we did that for as long as it was North American Aviation. And when we merged with Rockwell, I convinced Al Rockwell that we ought to continue it. And so we did. And the last one we had, I think there were only six of them remaining. But it was a great experience, and I developed a friendship with Jimmy unlike anything you could imagine. I went to his birthday parties, and he called me up and reminded me it was, his birthday was coming up. And I went to all of his anniversaries after he had retired. I look back on it, and I think, gosh, starting out looking at those heroes and getting to know them as person to person, and I look back on that as a career that's unbelievable. I'm going to now switch subjects on you and talk about a minute some of the kind of experiences that I've had that most people would never get exposed to. As an experimental test pilot, and the enthusiasm I had for learning everything about the aircraft company, I thought in terms of wanting to get a degree, and I had joined the service at 18. By the time I was 20, I was overseas in charge of 67 fighter pilots, and we had no American airplanes, and I didn't know what to do with my men, and I went to this colonel, and I said, where are we going to be built, and who are we going to attack to? He said, we don't have any airplanes. And I said, you suppose you could arrange to get us attached to the British? And he said, well, I'll try. And he did. And the British took us under their arms, and we flew Spitfires. And that was our first taste of combat. But I'd look back on that and think, 20 years of age and in charge of 67 fighter pilots, how could those people older than me have chosen someone that young and given them that much responsibility? Well, I'm very proud they did, and I hope I lived up to their expectations. But when we invaded Africa, I took my 67 pilots, we separated from the British, and went to North Africa. And when we got there, I was just gnashing at the bit to get back into combat. And I checked in with this colonel in the headquarters of where we made our first landing there. And I told him, I said, I'm eager to go to combat. He said, well, I'll send you out first. And I said, well, I sure appreciate it. And so I checked in wherever the headquarters was at that time, and they said, you've got more experience than anybody else. And the airplanes are starting coming overseas in crates, and they're going to be assembled here in Africa. And I said, well, who's going to be assembling them? And they said, we're going to get indigenous labor. I said, what are we going to do about communications between Arabic and English? And he said, we're going to have to make do. Well, you can imagine what happened. The airplanes were being assembled. And I'll tell you, you had to do walk-arounds like you never saw a walk-around done. I got into airplanes and checked the controls, and look, the ailerons are hooked up backwards. All kinds of malfunctions. Well, they started coming in by the hundreds, and I said, I've got to have some help. I was flying from daybreak till dark every day, one airplane after the other, and they had so many problems in the production line of making everything accomplish what it was supposed to do that I'd have to fly some airplanes maybe 10 times to get rid of all the squawks and say that it's ready to go into combat. And so we had two production lines when we started out, and they were P-39s and P-40s. And then we started getting Spitfires and Hurricanes and P-38s. They had their wings off, but they were pickled for the rest of the airplane, but they were up on top of the decks of container ships and freighters. And then they sent me to Rabat, And at that port, they brought in 60 of the first P-51s that went overseas, other than what the British had had. We said borrowed before the war. And I flew all 60 of those airplanes, and I only lost one P-51. But during the whole career of doing that, I had to have crews. I did test flights after battle damage on the bombers, and I had to bail out two crews. I managed to land the airplanes, but one of them was a belly in, and I was able to get the other one in after I got rid of the crew and landed it without any engines, without power. But that was going on every day. And at the time, I never realized what an enormous experience I was going through, because I had just about everything go wrong that could go wrong in an airplane. And I survived it. Well, I kept begging for combat, and they said, okay, we're going to the war zone. It moved up to Algiers in North Africa on the Mediterranean Sea. And I checked in thinking, oh boy, this is it. And I checked in, and his colonel said, you're going to be assigned to me. And I said, well, what commander, what group are you in command of, sir? And he said, I'm starting up a ferry command, and you're going to be my operations officer. I said, sir, I came over here to fight, and I want to go to combat. He said, well, that's what you may want to do, but the best thing you can do for our country right now is to get people checked out in all these fighters and battle-damaged bombers and lead them to the fighter units with brand-new airplanes as replacement aircraft for those that are lost in battle. And so I did that for about 3 months, and when we invaded Sicily, I led a flight of P-40s on the first trip we took where we landed over there, and I was in an operation set, and I was flying a B-25 leading these P-40s over, and I went in the tent to do the paperwork I had to do to turn the airplanes over to them, and this two-star general walked in. His name was Joe Cannon, and he was a fighter pilot. And he came over and he saw me with my Mae West on, and he said, young man, how'd the mission go? And I said, sir, I didn't have a mission, but I need to talk to you outside. I need some privacy. And so we went outside of the tent, and I told him what I'd been doing, and I said, I can hit the ground target upside down or right side up. I said, I can hit it out of four consecutive loops, and I have as much experience as anybody flying in the Air Force. And he said, young man, he said, if you're telling me the truth, he said, you'll have your orders in 2 weeks. Well, 2 weeks went by, a month went by, no orders. And finally, I got a call from a sergeant who was worked for the colonel that I was, well, he was head of the ferry command, and I was the operations officer. And his sergeant, because I had been a son of the sergeant originally, we had sort of an affinity for one another, and he said, Mr. Hoover, I was called Mr. as a flight officer, he said, your orders have been here for 3 weeks on the colonel's desk. And he told me when I reminded him that he hadn't acted on the orders, that you were supposed to be reported in to this fighting group. And the colonel said, I'm not going to give him the orders. And so the sergeant had told me, he said, if he ever finds out about it, you know what's going to happen to me. I said, oh, sure, I do. And you rest assured, he'll never know. And so as soon as I picked up the phone and I called the colonel, and I said, sir, somebody just called me from headquarters. And I said, they want to know why I hadn't reported to the 52nd Fighter Group. And he said, because I'm not going to release you. And so I said, well, sir, I really want to get one. He said, you aren't going to get it, so just accept it. Well, I had to take some Spitfire, so I got into B-25, and I took an extra crew with me. I flew put my foot locker in the back end of the airplane. I led the Spitfires to Palermo, which had just fallen. And I got there and I took my foot locker out and I called up Colonel McNichol, and he had watched me perform and testing some of those airplanes. And he said, "Boy, if you can get out of this kind of business you're in now," he said, "I'll make you a flight leader immediately and get you some promotions." And so I had told that to the general, and he had checked with McNichol, and so he welcomed me with open arms. He got all the fighter group together, and he started telling them what all I could do with all these different airplanes, all the other pilots. And he ended up his briefing by saying, "You've just seen what the airplane can do." And I, of course, used the Spitfire because that's what we were flying. And he said, "If I catch any of you doing it," he said, "you're going to be grounded because you don't have the background he has on flying airplanes." And he said, "I just want you to be aware of that. But I'm going to let him, if he has extra fuel when he comes back from a mission, he can take as much time as he wants to do different maneuvers as before he comes in and lands." And he was just the greatest person you could ever work for. And I flew 59 combat missions. And I was shot down twice, once by friendly fire, and I had to ditch on that one. And then when I got shot down by the Germans, I was in a Mark V. They took taking out Mark IX. Mark IX had the same engine as the P-51. 1,425 horsepower, and Bach Wolf had a little more horsepower than we had in the Mustang, and it was a real formidable airplane in dogfighting and combat. And I was on a mission with four airplanes, and we were just doing rhubarb work across from Corsica to over to southern France and part of Italy. And on this one mission, we were dropping little 100-pound bombs on shipping that was bringing supplies into the German forces in that theater. And I got one hit on a ship once, and I think it was a miracle if you ever got a hit on a ship with a 100-pound bomb. But I happened to hit the smokestack, and it blew. The whole boat blew up. But I think it was the luckiest bombing run anybody ever made. But we were going absolutely straight down vertical, so we took a lot of the air off at different angles where the bombs would go elsewhere. Well, I ignored the fellow that shot me down. Everybody was coming in at me, and I released my external fuel tank, pulled the handle, came right out of the floor of the airplane. But the tank was still there, and I only had 1,100 horsepower. So I was no match for these 190s. They could go 350 miles an hour. And so I just turned. Every time I look in the rearview mirror, we had big mirrors that went across the top of the windscreen and the windshield in the front. And when I'd see them getting into range, I'd go, whoof, and they'd go right on by me. And I'd roll back out and squirt a burst at them and then go back again like this where the next fighter was coming in on me. And I saw this lone airplane way out here, and I ignored him. Well, nobody could hit from way out there. It was a 90-degree deflection. And suddenly I did this, and about the time I did that, wham, I got hit. The whole engine blew up on me. And after the war, of course, I was captured, and that was that. But after the war, an artist in Germany called me up, and he said, "I've been following your career," and he said, "I have found the German pilot who shot you down." And I said, "Well, that's pretty interesting. I'd like to know something about him." And so he told me that he had 70 enemy aircraft to his credit, and that most of them were Spitfires. And that he had, he sent me all this information in print, and he said, the man had gone to his commanding officer, and he had been a sergeant pilot in the German Air Force. But he went to his commanding officer And he said, sir, I would like to remove two of my cannons from the ammunition. And his commander said, why? And he said, well, I get every kill I've had. He said, the airplanes blow up. And I hit first time I shoot at them, and I don't need that many guns, and I can start turning with those Spitfires. And his commander said, well, I've got to admit that. And so he said, okay, take them out. And he had already taken the guns out, and he did this, and boy, I was nailed, man. No doubt. But it was interesting after the war that this print came out, and I guess the company, the publishing company, put them out, must have put out 3,000 or 4,000 of them, and I signed them all, and he signed them all. He had lost both legs, and he was a diabetic, and his hand was shaking so bad. I never met him or saw him, but Gardy's told me this. When he signed the prints, he said it took him, I think it was 6 weeks to sign all those prints, and they sold out real fast. And the name of the painting was One Hell of a Shot, One Hell of a Deflection Shot. And it was interesting that that happened. Well, when the Korean War came along, I went back to the Pentagon and talked to them. I said, you're going to need better fighters. And it was a bit early in the program for the F-86 when I made that visit. And then I got to know the chiefs of staff after I'd become a civilian pilot. And they told me, oh, we aren't going to have any dogfights. I said, that's what they told me in war, too. And I said, he's the first person I reported to when I got over to England. He said, there's not going to be any more dogfighting. And I said, what are you going to do if you want to get on somebody's rear end? I said, you've got to fight to get there. And the people I talked with in the Pentagon said, we believe that you're right, but we're not going to do anything about it. Well, they did buy the 86, and they bought them in great numbers. And and I was a test pilot for that company by then, and it turned out to be a great airplane. And I had developed I should say some engineers came to me at North American, and they were mathematical geniuses in my opinion, and real technical people, aerodynamically wise. And they said, we've got a technique that we bet if we run it by you, you can figure it out, and we can put the bombs on the target every time. What would happen during World War II and in Korea, and I guess every war we've ever fought, when the bombers go over a target, a given target, you see bomb craters around strategic railroads or bridges, and as a result, there were pipe marks, but your target is still there in good shape, and the communication lines bringing supplies to the frontline troops are still operating. And I got up in the desert, and the technique was a pretty simple one. It's not too complicated. But if you're going vertical and you have no wind and you got a stationary target, you can actually just turn a little bit like this as you're dive bombing. And we built a lot of dive bombers over the years, more too even. And we put dive brakes on them so we know exactly what speed we would have at coming straight down, and that eliminated an awful lot of error if you had a still wind. Well, I would get up every morning, and we would go up to the lake bed at Muroc, and I would take off right at the first break of daylight with the bombs, and I'd go to the target area, and I release altitude, release airspeed. And they're the biggest things you got to worry about. But the most important one was, what is your angle of dive? Because you couldn't go straight down with the jet fighters. And so I took, I learned as an aerobatic pilot, we know where we are in angles. but this is for the troops. And so I get the engineers to draw up some templates, and I put dive angles, and you take a pencil. This is just for training, not for combat. And just so you would know, each of the pilots would know, and I'd brief them, what is your dive angle? And you may think you have 20 degrees or 30 degrees, but if I fly with them, they weren't on 20 or 30 degrees until they had this template telling them they were on 20 degrees or 30 degrees. But it was only in training. And so once you could put that in your mind, what your angle was, I could put those bombs in that target, just bang, one after the other. And I did that, and the people in the Pentagon came out. They said, we can't believe what we're reading in these reports. And I said, I think I can teach the Air Force how to do it real easy. And they said, how quick can you get back to go to Korea? I said, well, you tell me when you want me. They said, how about tomorrow morning? Well, we had another problem at that time. We had been dropping those 120 and 200 gallon external fuel tanks as soon as you go over enemy territory. Well, we couldn't build them fast enough because every mission, when they'd go across the enemy lines, they'd pick off the tanks, which would be empty, and they'd be ready to dogfight and have enough fuel still to get back to their home base. And so we just couldn't crank them out. North American had two facilities that were building nothing but drop tanks, and they started two more companies that were building them. And the C-124s were just running back and forth from Los Angeles to Korea with drop tanks. And they were so huge and bulky that you couldn't get a lot of tanks in the volume you had available to you in the transports. Well, our great engineers, again, whom I respect and appreciate so much, they said, we've got a 6-3 leading edge. And that will give us room to put about 140 gallons, 70 gallons on each wing by changing the shape of the wing without destroying the characteristics of the airplane. But the slats were aerodynamically actuated and the biggest safety factor in the world, and they were all automatic. Well, you don't like to complicate things, but if you could get an extra 70 gallons on each side, that would give you the range that you had with those big old bucky external tanks. And so this sounded like a good idea. And when we first flew the airplane, the pilot who made the first flight on it, he came back and he said, we're going 25 miles an hour faster with this new wing. And so about a week later, I was up in another airplane and I said, let's start out neck to neck and go to full throttle. I said, I don't believe it's faster. And sure enough, it wasn't. And here's a strange thing, and I'm going to get a little bit technical on you, but you had to have your pedal boom go out 50% of the width of the wing, or the chord of the wing. And if you have to have it out there 50% of that chord in order to have clear air so you get an accurate reading on your airspeed indicator. And so, obviously, they hadn't done that. Sure enough, they checked, and they had not put it out 50% further. So they corrected that, and then the company admitted to the Air Force it wasn't any faster. But this leading edge was such that if you were loaded up with tanks and bombs, if you lift it off too soon, it would get out of ground effect and then mush back in. And I had 11 miles lake bed up there, and I tried it, and I just skipped like this, skipped like that. But if I dropped the nose and got 5 knots more speed before lifting off, it would fly right out. And so I got to Korea, and before I got to Korea on the dives, went on the dive bombing thing, but the Air Force then wanted me to brief them about this bad characteristic. So I talked to the pilots, and initially when I got there, now this is a funny story, this will give you a chuckle, I think. I was about 35, I guess, at the time, and most fighter pilots are in their early 20s. And the two colonels met me when I got off the airplane and took me into their headquarters and got me squared away for a place to sleep. And I had already been to the general who was in command over there, and he said, if you're like all the other test pilots that have been out here, he said, you can pack up your bag and get out of here. He said, if you came over here to help us fight, I want you to stay and go. But just remember, I want you in the thick of battle. And so George Brown and Gene Dietrich is sitting over here. And he remembers when he was chief of staff, George Brown was a colonel, and he was executive officer to Glenn Barkas, who was a three-star general running the air war in Korea. And Barkas was tearing into me about all these test pilots that never helped us at all over here. And George said, General, if you'll excuse me, he said, this fellow's not just a test pilot. He's one of us. And he said, you're going to have a hell of a time keeping him out of the cockpit. Well, I got to this first fighter base, and the two colonels were taking me over to the office club for a drink, and as I was coming in, I heard some lieutenant whisper to her, what does that old F know about flying? I was gray-haired back then. Well, I overheard that. Now, they hadn't heard me brief or seen me fly or anything. I sat there, and I was on the expense account, and it was before the industrial complex military situation rose its head, and I said, bartender, drinks were a dime a piece, I think, something like that, and so I said, bartender, how about I want to buy everybody a drink in the bar, and so all these fighter pilots, and he said, well, what are you having? And I said, well, I'd like three shots of gin and a glass of water. And so everybody got their drink, and I said, gentlemen, cheers to all the fighter pilots who've ever lived. And they were just taking a sip. And so I drank some of my water. A few minutes, I excused myself and went to the bathroom. Got rid of it all, came back, and they still got about a half a drink, And I said, I don't think fighter pilots are like they used to be in my day. I said, you fellas don't drink very much. And so I said, bartenders, set everybody up for another drink. Well, I did this three times. And it, same thing over again. The next morning, with a lot of sore heads. And I didn't have a hangover, but I had a sore throat. Well, now the colonel gives a briefing, and he said, gentlemen, we've got an unusual situation here today. He said, this mission is we're going to a strategic bridge that we haven't been able to knock out since the war started, and it's supplying the frontline troops. And he's got a condition here that he's figured out how to hit targets, and he's here to show us how to do that. And I'd already briefed on the leading edge of the new wing, and he said, he's a civilian, and he's exposed to top-secret information. And if he has any kind of a problem, an engine failure or anything else, or has to bail out, he's not to hit the ground alive. Is that clear with everybody? I was saying, my gosh, I've used that parachute before. At any rate, we took off, and it was 16 airplanes, and I was number two to the colonel. It was the flight leader, the commander that was leading. And we had two targets. The first one was an airfield up in North Korea, and we got to the target, and it was overcast. And I told the leader, he said, we're going to have to go to the secondary target. I said, I can see a hole here if you want to try and get through there. He said, let's do it. And so he started in, and we went through it. And I had a chance. The ceiling was so low, it was 4,000 feet. And when I broke out at the angle I wanted, I saw the runway, and I pickled my bomb, and I pulled up, and as soon as I pulled up, I was back in the clouds in just seconds. And then I was now searching for the leader, and I spotted him, and we all the formation joined back together again, and we went to the secondary target, which was the bridge. And so the leader dove in on the bridge, and I was watching right behind him, and I didn't see anything, any bomb explosions or anything, and I picked up my bomb, and I looked back over my shoulder, and the bridge was gone. And somebody said, "Hey, boss, you got a direct hit on the bridge. It's on, not there." And I thought, I know I got that bridge. And we joined up. He had had an electrical failure, and both of his bombs were still hanging there. Well, that word spread around real fast, so every base I went to, they listened. They listened very closely. Well, some of the other kind of experiences that I've had were in the development of the F-100. I got back from Korea, and it had already made its first flight. Another pilot, it was Project Pilot. And we were going to have a fly-off with the McDonnell Corporation on the F-101 Blue Dude, a twin-engine bomber. And we only had two prototype F-100s. One of them wasn't flying yet. And the Project Pilot was going to be in the fly-off competition. And the president of the company invited me to go up with him to watch the fly-off. And we got up there, and the pilot, Project Pilot, was suited up in his G suit and everything ready to go. And he said, he asked me, he said, "You want to go to the briefing?" And I said, "Well, sure, I'll go with you." And I was in a business suit, and we went into the briefing, and they said, "If either one of you goes supersonic on this demonstration, you'll be eliminated, and the other company will get the contract." And, of course, each of us, a pilot always wants to be right on the feather edge and demonstrate an airplane or making it look good. So, got back to the airplane, and I was standing there with the two people who founded the company, and this pilot guy came over to me, and he said, "You know, I've been thinking since we've been to that briefing. You know more about demonstrating airplanes than I do." And he said, "I want you to take the flight." I said, "Well, George, I've only got 30 minutes in the airplane." And I said, "Well, I just took it off and did some handling quality checks and came back in." And he said, "Oh, hell, you've got so much experience, you'll handle it okay." And so I said, "Well, I'll use your equipment." And so I just got in there with my suit, hooked up, and took off. And I didn't know it, but the pilot who had been flying it said, "We don't have a pilot-induced oscillation." Well, that wasn't what we called it in the F-86 program. One of the pilots was on a routine test one day, and he yelled, "Jesus Christ!" And so everybody in the engineering said, "What in the world has happened to him?" Well, it is a pilot-induced oscillation, but all the test pilots were calling it the JC maneuver. And a fellow who was head of structures was a very religious man. And so he told the president of the company, he said, "Make those test pilots quit calling it the JC maneuver." And so we were ordered not to say that anymore, so it was pilot-induced oscillation. Well, they had already advertised to the Pentagon that we didn't have that in the F-100 as we had in the 86. And what would happen when you were coming along and you'd hit rough air and you'd get a bump and the airplane would start to pitch up or pitch down and you'd react like you're supposed to, but you'd get out of phase with what the airplane control system was doing. And it was called a pilot-induced oscillation. It's a weight of your arm on the controls. Well, I was told not to go supersonic, as I mentioned. I was waiting on the east side of the lake bed, and the Voodoo was doing its thing, and I wasn't able to watch it very much, but I was trying to feel out the airplane and learn as much as I could about it with only 30 minutes time. And they called me in and said, "It's your turn to come in." And I rolled over, and I was about 15,000 feet, and I wanted to be as fast as I could be, but I knew I couldn't be supersonic. So I started picking up a little too much speed, and I took their engine out of afterburner, and I pulled out of the dive, and I had lost too much airspeed on the pullout because of the G-forces, and I decided to hit the afterburner to get that speed back up there close to Mach 1. And I did, and that pits the nose up, and I just went through the most gigantic pilot-induced oscillation you've ever seen. And I just pulled straight up, and I did what I intended to do. My plan was to go maximum speed, without going supersonic, and go vertical, completely out of sight, rolling right on out of sight. Well, I did that. And then I came back, and I did low-speed flight, landing on one wheel and then the other. The airplane had a very high angle of attack because it had no flaps, and the flaps keep you from coming in like this. It makes you come in like this. And so I did that demonstration, and I parked back where I'd started. And Dutch Kennenberg, who was the chairman, he came over to me, and he said, "Bob, you remind me of a story. This nephew had a very rich uncle, and he had a new baby, and he was sitting on the front porch, and he asked his rich uncle to hold the baby while he took a picture. He said the baby just tinkled all over his lap." I said, "That's just what you've done to our company." Well, fortunately, they bought both airplanes. Well, the next thing that happened, the second airplane was built, and that was my project. And they asked me to fire the cannons for the first time. Now, this was a pretty important test because at altitude, when you fire the guns, when they're mounted on the side of the intake, the front of the airplane, all of the oxygen is taken out of the air, and so the engine can be starved for oxygen. And it actually sometimes flame out under certain conditions. But I could never get it to flame out. Well, here I am in this new airplane, first time we're going to do it. And I was up pretty high, I was about 40,000 feet. And just flying along, beautiful sunny day. And all of a sudden, just minding my own business, I had the loudest explosion I'd ever heard. About like sitting on an 80 millimeter gun. And my feet came off the rudder pedals, and dust came up off of the floor. And I got on the microphone, and I said, "I've got a real problem. I think I've got a broken fuel line in the engine area. Because a fireball came out of the front of that airplane and completely covered the airplane, and poof, and another one would hit. And it jumped, make you jump just like that." And they were hearing that noise while I was talking to them about what was going on. I said, "I'm shutting the engine down because I believe I've got a separated fuel line and we don't have enough oxygen for the engine to fire to say relit, and it's just torching off like this." And they said, "Well, what are your intentions?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to dead stick it into the lake bed. I've got 11 miles. And they said, "We've already been discussing that, and you've been in on the discussions. We don't think a pilot can survive landing the airplane because of the high angle of attack." And they reminded me of the 102 accident, which it's on its first flight, out of the old main base at Muroc. A very close friend of mine, Dick Johnson, was taking off, and he had an engine failure going to the west, so he didn't have the benefit of the lake bed. And he went into the terrain, and it was a Delta design, and when his tail hit, he slapped down like that. Of course, broke the nose gear off, and he broke his back in three places. I went to the hospital to see him that night, and his legs were spasming like this. And I said, how bad are you hurt? And he said, I've broken my back in two places. And I said, well, Johnny, what does it feel like when you've got a broken back? He said, you feel like you've got an orange or a grapefruit where the fracture takes place. And I said, boy, that's interesting. About the time the doctor came in, and I said, he was just telling me about the spasms and or the high belt. And he said, yes, that's nature's way of trying to protect the spinal cord. Well, on the dead set landing that I had to make with this airplane, everybody's hollering, bail out. And I'd gone through that on a lot of different situations of testing. And I was being paid to save the airplane, find out what's wrong, and let's move forward. Well, they said, what's your hydraulic pressure? And I said, I have a windmill air turbine out. And that was when you had no engine that would power your hydraulic system. And it was a retractable type fan. And so you pull a handle and the door would open and the fan would start turning. And that give you the hydraulic pressure to fly the airplane. Well, I had pressure. And it turned on to the final approach over the edge of the lake bed, and they said, we got all the fire equipment and ambulance heading out on the lake bed. I said, don't worry about it. It's a piece of cake. I've got it made. And I was holding exactly the airspeed that needed to be held, which was a recommended speed of 285 knots. That's over 300 miles an hour. And about that time, I thought, I'm going to start my flare about here. And I started to pull, nothing happened. I looked down and the hydraulic pressure was zero. And so I'm headed for the ground at 300 miles an hour. And when I hit, I gotta tell you, it was some kind of a crash. I came to, I was stunned. And when I came to, I looked and the instrument panel was down on my ankles. The landing gear was gone. And the airplane was 200 feet in the air. And the only control I had that was manual was the rudder. And I was flying like this 200 feet up. So I stood on the rudder, and I never got level before it contacted the ground again. And when that wing caught, it was a 45-degree sweep wing, swept wing, it started part where it was pinwheeling across the lake bed. And, of course, I was unconscious then. And when they got the canopy open, I cleared up and they said, how bad are you hurt? And I said, I've got a broken back. And I had the grapefruit right up in here. And so I knew it was broken. Thank goodness I had learned that from my friend. So I said, get a doctor and get a crane and get the charge out of the seat and have me craned out in the seat. And when the doctor gets here, he'll take me out of the seat. And that's what they did, and I told the doctor I felt I had a broken back. But he had never heard about the orange or grapefruit feeling. And so he took me over to the hospital in an ambulance, and they said, he x-rayed it. And he said, you're okay, you just got a strained back, and it's just a muscular problem. But they only x-rayed here, and the same way from the back. And I said, he said, get up and walk out of here. I said, no, sir, doctor. I said, I'm going to stay on this stretcher. I said, get me to a telephone. So he got me to a telephone. I called up our company flight surgeon, like the military is a flight surgeon. He took care of all the test pilots and made sure we were responding to healthy conditions. And I told him I felt I had a broken back and I wouldn't let anybody touch me. He said, I'll send a DC-3 up and I'll meet you when you get back here to L.A. and I'll take you to a good Samaritan hospital where I know we can get some real fine help. Well, he did, and I got to the hospital and they x-rayed me through the sides. And if I had moved, the fracture was up in here, I would have been a paraplegic for the rest of my life because it was a diagonal slash break like that. So, another lucky day for me. And I fully recovered. And guess what? My wife had been trying to have a baby for nine years. And I didn't have anything to do. So she got pregnant.
I was supposed to cut him off 20 minutes ago, but I didn't think I'd get away with it. We've got time for some questions, but if I could maybe start it with, since you were the test pilot on the F-86, recently with, on the website for the Air and Space magazine, there's been some discussion about the possibility that the F-86 actually went supersonic prior to the Bell X-1. Do you have any thoughts on that, or would... If they're not saying it did, so it was just possible that people heard sonic booms and that sort of thing. So
thank you.
Could comment
thank
for
you, Jack. Well, Lee Atwood, who was head of the company, and I had become good friends. And he lived to be 96. And I was watching the Super Bowl game with him and having lunch. And he said, what do you think of Al Blackman's book? He'd been a test pilot with us and a very good one. He did the Zell launches where they go zero off of the back of a truck with a 130,000-pound rocket on the bottom of it. And he did a great job on that program. At any rate, he wrote this book, and he thought he had researched everything. Well, I was on the X-1 program, and during that program, Chuck and I had other assignments, and each day when the X-1 wasn't going to fly, we'd be testing other airplanes. And we'd go into the operations and find out what airplane we were going to be flying. There's a lot of different airplanes. And this particular day, it said, Chase pilot for the first flight of the YF-86. And I called up North American, and they were up on the north side of the lake bed. And I said, I need a stopwatch timing with you for your takeoff time, so I'll be right in position to go with the airplane when it lifts off. And so it came in. He'd released brakes, and I had the gear and flaps down on my airplane. I stayed right beside him. Flight lasted about 45 minutes. I never got more than 500 feet away from him. And that was on the 9th of October in 1947. He said in his book that the F-86 went faster than Mach 1 before October the 14th when Chuck actually went Mach 1. There's no way, because the airplane, when he took off, the gear came up, and after his 45-minute flight, he said to controllers, the engineers, I'm going to extend the gear now. And check the extension. He put the gear handle down. The nose gear wouldn't come out and lock. It stayed about 45 degrees. And engineering said, try it again. So he tried it several times, and always the same thing. And engineering, it said, George, we've been discussing it here, and we want you to belly the airplane in. And so I said to George, I said, George, I've landed during the war with tricycle geared airplanes without the nose wheel, and I said, you're not going to do very much damage to the airplane at all, but if you belly it in, you're going to have structural damage all across the bottom of the airplane. And I said, you can fix a nose wheel problem and be back in the air in a few days. And the engineering said, George, you just remember who you're working for. I was a lieutenant in the Air Force, of course. And he went on around, and he had the gear up. I said, I'll make you a hero if you listen to me. I said, put that gear down, gear handle down, and let me talk you into the landing. I said, put your gear and flaps out. And I said, as soon as those wheels touch, you pull up the flap handle, and you hit the speed brakes, because speed brakes will make you pitch up. And I said, and hold that stick in your gut. And he did. And I said, keep holding it in your gut. And his nose went up a little bit. And I said, now hang on right there and just stay there. Well, as the airplane slowed down because of the aerodynamic braking, air friction air, the nose wheels started coming out of the 45 degree position, and the lower the airspeed, we got down to about 50 in the gear lock, just like that. Now, they didn't know how, immediately, without some real tinkering around, how to get the capacity of the hydraulic pressure to that nose wheel to overcome the drag of the gear door, which was attached to the wheel. There's a big flat plate area like that, and it was on the jacks for 2 weeks. Well, on the 14th, I was sitting at 42,000 feet, and Chuck and I both figured that this would be the day. And he would be looking for me when he'd drop out of the darkness of the Bombay. He'd look up skyward, and it's all tough coming out of the dark into the bright sunlight. But as soon as he would come out and could get his eyes adjusted, he'd head for my contrail, because I would be in the right position for him to get back to the lake bed where he wanted to be. And I'd go with him all the way down, because I had the engine and he had nothing. He was dead stick. And so I stayed with him. And when he went by me, he was heading for my airplane, because he's chasing my contrail. And I was doing 8/10 Mach number. And boy, he was really coming at me fast. And when he went by, I took a picture. I had a photo nose with cameras in, and I got the picture, and it was framed just perfectly. And it was the first picture of the supersonic flight with diamond shockwaves coming out of the back of the airplane. We had that picture on President Truman's desk the next morning. Somebody flew all around to get it back to me. But there's no way that the F-86 could have gone fast and sound. For this reason, it didn't have an engine that had put out enough power. It had a different engine than it later went into production with. And then, once we got the General Electric engine instead of the Allison engine, the 86 had plenty of power and could then go supersonic on the vertical. But it certainly didn't happen before October the 14th. I'm so pleased that Jack asked me to explain that to you, because, you know, it's history. But I don't like for people to think something that isn't fact, isn't true. And so I'm glad Jack asked me that question, and thank you.
We've got time for about two questions. Anybody have any? Well, that must have been a very comprehensive brief you gave here.
Over here.
Oh, I'm sorry, right here. Okay.
Sir?
Do you have a favorite airplane?
The question is, do you have a favorite airplane? It seems like every time I fly a new airplane, I fall in love with it. It's like that Lady of Fun, Brown Heels. Really, just one short story. It's very important. I was performing in the Paris Air Show, and I did every other year for a great many years, and with military airplanes. And this one year, I was flying the Northrop airplane, and Tom Jones was the head of the Northrop Company CEO at the time, and he had called me up a couple of months before the show, and he said, can you come over and have a cup of coffee with me? And I thought, oh, Tom's going to try and get me to come to his company. Mm-hmm. I went over and had a cup of coffee with him, and he said, how would you like to fly the newest model of the F-5 in the Paris Air Show? And I said, Tom, I could never convince North American to let me, or Rockwell to let me do that. And he said, work on it for me. And I said, I wouldn't do it anyway, because I've been the president of the Society of Experimental Test Pilots on two occasions. It would be the biggest insult to your test pilots that they could have. He said, I knew you were going to say that, and so did they. He said, they want job security. And every time they announce their low bear is going to fly, the people quit eating and drinking and come outside to watch. And he said, I think if you fly the airplane, we'll sell 3,000 of them. He said, we've been talking to an awful lot of countries about buying the airplane. And I called Paul from the plant rep's office, and I said, why, you can't. He said, you've been up in the chamber recently? And I said, no. He said, are you in the reserves? And I said, no. He said, how about the Air Guard? I said, no. He said, have you flown a T-38? I said, no. And he said, I'm going to let you fly the airplane. And I said, well, I don't know how I'm going to work around this myself. And I called up George Brown. Now, George Brown was a colonel that I had been to his command and did a lot of different in Korea. And he was the one I was talking about who was the aide to General Parker. And he was now chief of staff of the Air Force. He was a four-star general running the whole show. And Gene Dietrich was there here in Washington. And I called George Brown, and he said, just get in the damn airplane and fly its pants off. I thought about it. He said, I assume you want to do it. And I said, as quick as we can. The Paris Air Show is about 2 weeks away. And so he said, well, just fly the airplane. Well, this colonel, I still had a problem with him. Well, then Gene Dietrich received a phone call from the three-star general he worked for, and he said, make this happen. Mm-hmm. And Gene called, he said it right up here. Gene called me up and he said, you son of a gun, you had to know how to ruin a dear friend's friendship. He said, I worked the whole weekend trying to make this work out. Well, I had a loss of sleep over it because I thought, what if it's a one of a kind airplane? What if I blow a tire and the airplane is destroyed? And I thought, I'm going to call up Tactical Air Command. And I called up the training command first, and I said, can I come over there and get a checkout in the T-38? And so I went over and did that and got my check right and took the written test. And then I went and called up the general at Edwards, and I said, can I get a chamber check ride? And he said, yes. So I was flying my P-51, so I went up there, got that out of the way. And then I decided I wouldn't have George's reputation in jeopardy. I put the airplane 2 hours. I worked out a routine that I thought would be pretty good. And I went to engineering at Northrop, and I said, I'd like to fly this airplane at lightweight. It's a 7.33G airplane, and my rule of thumb has been that if you have less weight, that you won't damage the structural design of the airplane by putting extra G, as long as it's within a certain limit. And they said, how many G do you want? G's do you want? And I said, 8.5, because I can make this airplane talk at 8.5 G's. Because it's doing very well now, and I can make it do a lot better. And so they said, okay. Well, boy, I tell you, I made a G-U.S. airplane at 8.5 G's. But you really had to know what you were doing, because I physiologically knew, because of all the research flying I'd been doing on centrifuges. They put Chuck and myself through some pretty serious testing, trying to prove what we could survive with. And on the centrifuge, they take us right up to unconsciousness. And so I knew about the choking, the coughing mode. At 8.5 G at 42 seconds, you go into an uncontrolled, you have no control over it, like this. And at the end of 42 seconds, if you don't wrap it off on the G, you're going to black out, and you don't know what the rest is. But they say, go ahead and do it. Boy, every time I get into the coughing mode, I knew I had the limits. But boy, before I got there, I had the airplane really talking. And I got back after it was all over, and lo and behold, they did sell 3,000 airplanes. But Tom Jones had asked me beforehand, he said, what kind of remuneration do you want? And I said, Tom, I don't want any remuneration. I said, it's an American airplane, and we'd I don't like seeing offshore gold blow. If this airplane doesn't win the competition, another country's airplane will, and that'll be money we lose in our country. And he said, well, he said, you want to get something in the mail. And I got a letter, and it said, Dear Bob, for 11 days at the Paris Air Show, you work for me. But with this, these stock certificates, I'm now working for you.
What a remarkable man. He could make an airplane talk, any airplane he ever got into, and he could fly the pants off airplanes. Truly a remarkable aviator. Probably this country will never see the likes of a man like Bob Hoover, who passed away this past Tuesday, October 25th, at the age of 94. And I'm so thankful that I had the pleasure of meeting the man, a great, great American aviator. So thanks, Bob, for all the air shows that you put on. Thrilled so many people and did so much for this country. You'll be remembered for a long, long time. Well, that's our show today. We hope you liked it. Rather long, but that was just a little small sampling of the man Bob Hoover and what he did for America and what he did for aviation, who he knew, and we're glad to have presented that 2 days after his death. So we'll see you again next Thursday when we once again, this time, try to pull out a story from the Eastern Files for our broadcast Thursday, the first Thursday of November in this case, and that at 3 p.m. So we hope we'll see you then. And until next week and another broadcast from the Eastern Files, we say so long, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.